Hello and welcome. I am your host, Neil Ward, and I'm grateful that you are taking time out of your day to learn more about design educators' paths to tenure. I truly appreciate it. On this episode of Tell It to Neil, we are chatting with Assistant Professor of Graphic Design, Gary Rozank, from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, in Baltimore, Maryland. Let's listen in. Hi, Gary, and welcome to Tell It to Neil. How are you?
I'm doing good, Neil. How are you doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. So let's talk about our path into academia.
Sure.
But let's back up a little bit and tell us a little bit how you found your way into the field of design.
Okay. So happenstance, it definitely wasn't a planned thing. I was working for a company that duplicated diskettes. This is before CDs. This is before, so floppy disks, you know, the standard 3 1/4. And they needed some. They needed a pre-press technician, and I'm the one who figured out how to do, you know, how to use InDesign, Photo. Well, that wasn't even InDesign then. It was Illustrator and Quark and whatnot to get the artwork from the customers onto our equipment, you know. So, and then I started going to a community college for the software, and then occasionally, you know, I just slowly built up. Next thing I know, you know, I'm almost in an associate's degree. So then I decided, and so then I, you know, I lost that job. And when I was trying to apply for other jobs, I was like halfway stuck between, I was overqualified for pre-press, but I wasn't quite qualified anymore. I wasn't qualified for like graphic design jobs. So that's when I decided to go back to school full time for graphic design. So that's how I got in there. Very, very backwards.
That's all right. Where were you living at the time? Were you in Baltimore or were you elsewhere?
I was in Cleveland, Ohio.
Ah.
That's where I grew up. So I spent the bulk of my career, life, if you will.
So during that time, finding your way through, what did you love or dislike most about that or those jobs? Was there anything?
With the pre-press stuff, you know, I was kind of like the thread, regardless of whether I was doing pre-press, whether I'm, you know, doing freelance work or the, you know, going to grad school or even to today, it's the ability to always learn something new. So I get caught up more in the idea of learning something new, trying to execute it myself. And design is just, it's an infinite. I mean, there's always something new to learn. I mean, case in point, you know, even if you learn everything there is to know about the web, but now what about augmented reality and virtual reality? How are you going to be designing for that? So there's like never an end to that. So that's what excites me most, is just learning something new. But I think what I hate most about that little personality trait is that I also am not really excited about like finishing or polishing anything. So I learn how to do something, I get excited about it, and then, you know, I get bored with it. And so I never really like master it, and I don't want to. I mean, that's the other part of it.
Interesting. So you kind of learn enough to get yourself through to the next challenge.
Exactly.
Hmm. Interesting. It's kind of one of my favorite things about design too. So you went to school, and I assume after you were, did you receive a BFA degree, and then you went back out to work, or did you go BFA into your MFA?
Kind of both. It's
okay.
It's goofy, but again, like I had a ton of community college credits. I was like literally over the course of, I don't remember how many years, but over quite a few years, I would just like slowly built up. So it got me to the point where once I was canned from my job, I decided to go back to school full time for design, but I was able to get my BFA in, I mean, not my BFA, my BA, in three semesters. Now, granted, those three semesters were, I was taking 16 credits, 20 some credits, and then like 19 credits to do it. But I didn't have a job. So I mean, it was like literally going to school full time. And so then once I graduated, I immediately kind of moved to Arizona. And I knew at that point, within maybe like 3 or 4 months of moving to Arizona, that I was going to go to grad school. So I ended up working with a pre-press. I ended up going to like, you know, a print shop, and I was doing pre-press and graphic design there. And, but I also, like, that summer before I moved, I was also kind of, you know, I would guess a contract junior designer for a design firm in Cleveland. So, like, literally I had everything kind of going on at once during that little transition there.
So then going to getting your MFA, was there a point where you were thinking, ooh, you know what, design education might be for me? Or was it more about learning more and then being an educator just kind of came out of that?
Everything but the last one. In my undergrad, my professor, Jennifer Visacchio Grady, she's amazing. But at the time, she was doing, she and her husband, and along with two other friends from grad school, had their own design firm. But they were doing like select work. And then so that she had the teaching gig, and that, like, that business model, if I'm going to call it a business model, like, really appealed to me. It's like, okay, I can have the safety of the ivory tower, you know, paycheck, but I can also like do like the select freelance work that like I found really interesting, or, you know, like low pressure kind of stuff. And so seeing her, so she inspired me to like think of teaching as a profession. And so to teach full time, I knew I also needed an MFA. So the MFA was kind of a response to that, but also at the same time, you know, I only had 3 semesters of a BA, and I kind of knew that I was missing a lot. So going to get my MFA was kind of like dual purpose. Was I chose a school, not just because I was living in Arizona. I ended up going to the University of Arizona. So it wasn't just out of convenience. The school it's a good school. And it gave me opportunities to be a teacher. So I knew I was going to build, you know, my curriculum vitae in a way that I would be able to, you know, if I wanted to do a teaching job. So that was a conscious decision. And then once I got to teaching my own courses, that's when I was like, yeah, this is me. This is what I do.
That's amazing. So when you,
yeah,
oh, go ahead.
All this stuff is just like literally, there's never been like a decision that I've had to painstakingly make. It's just, this is just the logical next step.
It just felt right.
Yeah.
When you were at U of A in your master MFA program, what type of work did you do there? And if you can talk a little bit about your thesis project.
Okay, sure. The U of A has their master's program is really kind of, it's interdisciplinary, because the cohort that I went into, we called ourselves Arte 13, but it was printmakers, it was photographers, it was sculptors, it was performance artists. And yes, I did take design specific courses, but at the same time, I'm also coupled with all these other people. So it was really truly interdisciplinary. Now, I don't know if that was by design or just like my cohort that I went through. So I did a lot of like printmaking, like woodcuts, kind of using that as kind of using like almost illustration as a design medium, I guess, is one way to put it. I also at that point, you know, had access to a letterpress, so I started doing a lot of letterpressing. And mind you, before I started, I was actually like really like big on web. So I was a web designer before I went to did my MFA. But when I got to my MFA, I didn't do any web until my thesis. And I think that was partly because, you know, I truncated my BA experience. So I felt like I wanted to learn about design history, and I spent a lot of time doing that as well. And then my thesis is loosely, the best way I think to describe it is my thesis was about everybody's attachment to a sense of place. So mind you, I had just spent, 30 years living in Cleveland, Ohio, and now I'm here in the middle of the desert in Arizona. And so, I just started thinking about place. And so, designers and people in general have such a strong connection to place. And so that's what my thesis kind of became about, is like, how do you communicate that sense of place to somebody so they have the same, connection to it that you do, but also like, how do you leverage other people's, place as a, in a form of communication. And so that's what it was. But at the same time, I think anybody who did their MFA, I don't know if they came up, if they selected their thesis project the same way that they approach research when they go into teaching and they're going up for tenure. I think they're two kind of different levels of research, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I would think they are a little bit different just due to the demands when you're not in school full time and you're on the other end of things.
Yeah, it's just I think when, and I can only speak for myself, but I feel like with the MFA, you know you have to make a thesis when you walk in, right? So you're starting to come up with a thesis, but you're not really discovering your research passion. So you're picking a thesis and then researching to make it. Whereas when you go into academia, you're hired based on your research passion, and it's cultivated and it manifests itself completely differently because the research informs the thesis instead of, the thesis is the starting point and then you're trying to make the research to justify it.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. So this is a nice segue. So the research that you did and the thesis project about the attachment to a sense of place, how and or did it apply to teaching courses when you started an academic position? I mean, did that transfer to any courses, or did it kind of lightly get incorporated, or tell me about it?
It really didn't. And I think the reason it didn't was more about the courses that I was teaching. So it wasn't applicable directly. Yeah, it was a little bit, but just the courses I was teaching when I first, got into the thing were web courses. The way I approached them in the beginning was like teaching HTML and CSS. So that was the focus. So it wasn't about sense of place where, later on when I started teaching, kind of like more UX or UI centric courses, or even getting into like exhibition design, yeah, then that became totally applicable. So it depends on the course that I was teaching, I guess, is it would be applicable. But I just felt like, at the very beginning, it really wasn't. But I think that was more a reflection of the courses that I was asked to teach.
Yeah, and unfortunately, when you're first starting out, you kind of have to go where you find a position. And let's talk about that. So after you graduated with your MFA from U of A, how did you go about finding your first academic position, and where did you land? Or actually, tell me the timeline from graduating from U of A to where you are now.
Sure. It started not when I graduated, but the semester, my final semester, it started the fall of my third year, because my U of A is a 3-year program. Well, you can do it in 2, but they recommend 3, and I did it in 3. So in the fall of that year of my last year, I started sending out applications, and I sent out, I'm not kidding, over 60 applications. I literally applied to everywhere that I met the minimum qualifications for. So then January, February, I started, you know, doing all the interviews and stuff while I was also working on my thesis. And I was literally, you know, by March, April, I'm going to on-campus interviews while I'm working on my thesis. And so I think I actually had an offer letter from Truman State University, maybe even before I graduated. I mean, we're talking about like, you know, within a matter of weeks that they, you know, those two things coincided. And so I graduated in May of 2008, and in fall, you know, like September of 2008, I'm, you know, teaching full time in a tenure track position at Truman State University.
So do you think that that is a normal occurrence in MFA grads, that they're looking for jobs in the fall, or do you think that they kind of wait until springtime to start looking, or?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I was the only designer who kind of was seeking teaching position. And so my cohort, you know, like I said, sculptors, and I don't know what their intent was. So, but I know, externally, some other people that designers that were going for MFA that also wanted to teach. Yeah. They started the process around the same time I did. If you look at the academic cycle, the call for applications goes out, you know, the dean's office usually notifies the department, you know, by September or October at the latest, that, you know, your position has been approved, you know, a search has been approved. Then that immediately goes out, and then you start, you know, collecting applications. You start reviewing applications in early January, and start doing the on-campus interviews then, and, you know, like doing the Skypes and the phone interviews and the on-campus, you know, February, March, and April. It's almost kind of too late.
A little bit. Now, did you ever experience a CAA conference where you were interviewing there, or did you?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I did that. This is going to come up later, but you ask about mentoring. I had really good people all along. So I had somebody who's a printmaker who graduated a year ahead of me. He's like, hey, you know, CAA, there's a lot of interviews there. You know, you should like maybe go the year before you actually have to apply, just to check it out, get a feel for it, experience what you're going to go through. And so I did. And then, so when I went the next year, I mean, I had all kinds of interviews set up, and I, you know, I knew what to expect, and I knew what people were looking for.
It is definitely quite an experience there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know how effective it is, because it's a glorified Skype interview.
A little bit.
I mean, not to knock CAA.
No, not at all. Not at all.
I just feel like that interview process, the way that everybody interviewed me at CAA, was it skipped the phone interview, essentially. And so now at this point, this, you know, you can do a Skype and you can see the person, so you can read their body language and things like that, that you would get from an in-person conversation that you may not get from a phone, you know?
Yeah. Ooh, very true. Yeah, it, from my experience, when I interviewed there, it was more of a, let's get as many interviews as we can while we're there. And for an MFA graduate, like, it is great experience in interviewing.
Yes, that is true.
Now we're at fall of 2008, and you're at Truman State University. Mm-hmm. So you're at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County now.
Yep.
What happened between those 10 years?
Quite a bit. The first one with Truman State, and I truly adore the university. So me leaving them was like no reflection on them. It was kind of twofold. It was 2008, and if anybody remembers the financial crisis that happened in the fall of 2008, so I literally got an there's an email from the president of Truman that, you know, there's potentially a 25% budget cut. And I was a new line. I wasn't even like, my position was a new line. It wasn't even like filling, you know, a retirement. It was literally a new line that the, you know, that the chair had just fought for. And I was like, hey, I know you can't guarantee me that I'm safe as an, you know, but is this line safe? And the chair could not get assurances from the dean, from provost, from anybody that position, that the new line was going to be safe from the budget cuts. It's like, I got to apply to jobs. And so I did. I applied. Just a few. I didn't want to, you know, I just looked low. I didn't want to like move halfway across the country again. So I you know, like maybe like an 8-hour radius around, and one of them was Columbia College Chicago. And I ended up getting, you know, offered that position in Columbia College. And while I love Truman State, I didn't love Kirksville, Missouri. And like, who's going to pass up, you know, living in Chicago? And so I moved to Chicago. And I loved living in Chicago, but Columbia wasn't a good fit for me. It was, I mean, I went from a department that had 120 graphic design majors and 3 faculty to 11 full-time faculty, but 1,200 students.
Ooh.
I mean, I was advising students that I never had in a course. And they were going through some like identity crisis growing. I don't know. Yeah. Identity crisis, I think, because when I started there, they had just switched to a tenure track from a teaching college. And so they like kind of tenured all the lecturers that were there. And so like nobody like really knew like how to like go and, you know, how do we evaluate this tenure thing? Cause it was new to them. And so that was going on. But then I had met my wife in Chicago, and her family was in Northern Virginia, and they had a bunch of health, her father, her mother, and her brother-in-law, they all had different kinds of varying health issues. So it became obvious that, you know, we would need to help with them some way, shape, or form. So when you couple that with, you're not really super enthralled with your job, and she taught in Chicago public schools, and it's not like they're the best public school system either. So we're like, let's move. So we started looking for jobs in the Midwest that were, you know, not Midwest, I'm sorry, Mid-Atlantic, that are, you know, close to her family. And a couple of positions opened up in Baltimore, and I was offered both of them, and I ended up taking the one at UMBC. So that's how I got to Baltimore.
So what made you choose the UMBC position over the other one? Was there anything that kind of...
Yes. One was more teaching focused. And the other one was more, and UMBC is more research focused, and they were both, I would have taken either or if I only had one option. It wasn't like one was a bad option. They were just different options. And one of them was, a research institution. So UMBC is Research 2. So I don't know the difference between Research 1 and Research 2, but I know that Research 2 is a lot different than like a teaching university. And so there's more resources for, they take research here at UMBC very seriously, and they fund it.
Oh, that is nice.
Yep, so you get startup funds that you can use for equipment, you can use for travel. I mean, you use it for whatever you want, as long as you can justify it that it improves your scholarship slash research. So that's why I chose UMBC. I guess like the follow up, I'm going to anticipate your question. Why would I prefer research over teaching?
Of course.
I can't, I'm trying to like, why did that appeal to me more than teaching? Cause like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a teacher. I don't know. It was just at the time that just made most sense to me. I really can't.
Okay.
I can't quantify it.
No, sometimes it's good to go with your gut.
It was literally that. I just felt UMBC was going to be a better fit for me.
Let's talk about your research and scholarship. So back in your MFA thesis, you were researching attachment to sense of place. And you've been teaching at some institutions. And then now you're at UMBC. Did your research morph when you landed there, or how did it change?
That's interesting, and I'd love to know what other people have done. So I had 4 years under my belt at Columbia College Chicago, and so my research there was pedagogy. How do we teach design? Because I was, when I started there, I was working with a colleague. There was like a, we were brought in at the same time, and there was like a pie in the sky that the department chair walks in and says, "Blue sky, come up with a new BFA. And so my colleague and I, we ran with it, you know, and this was, you know, 2009. And what we did when in hindsight was kind of a very visual design heavy user experience design program. So there was a ton of research, but all on the front end. So the idea was you're learning about usability research at the freshman and sophomore level, so you can apply it to your design practice in the junior and senior year. So my research was literally like design pedagogy. How do you implement that? So when I went to UMBC, I didn't fight for or try to, you know, have any of those 4 years count. Because I quickly identified UMBC took their research vastly differently than Columbia College did. And I felt like, you know, I can try to fight to get a couple of years of, you know, towards tenure, or I could just go there, see how things shake out and apply for tenure early if things, you know, so that was my rationale. And so when I started there, I actually, I kind of dropped the whole user experience design, research into user experience design, like how are we teaching it? And I focus more on just like, you know, the design pedagogy of web design, responsive web design, because this is, you know, 2013, media queries have been out for 2 years. So that seemed like a really fruitful endeavor. And so that's where I kind of started. And it slowly morphed over the course of my time from being about pedagogy to actually, I think, more about design, you know, responsive web design best practices throughout for professionals, not just students, because it is such a new industry, if you will.
Yes.
So I decided to start over on purpose. But I'm curious. I'm curious if other people would like kind of try to transfer what they've already done.
I don't. You'll have to keep listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
For design educators that are in the first maybe year or two of their tenure track position, you had just mentioned that when you switched positions, you really didn't fight for years towards tenure. Can you describe that idea to listeners who may not be familiar with that process when you switch when you switch tenure track jobs halfway to tenure?
Yeah, literally. It was literally halfway. I guess like the only way that I could to give an applicable life lesson, I think it's, you would have to like kind of sit back and assess where your own personal research was at. So when I was at Columbia College, my research was about understanding the user experience design, kind of this marriage with, you know, visual design. And I, you know what, let me back up. My colleague who I taught with at Columbia College, her undergrad was in architecture. So we were kind of marrying it does mirror what modern user experience is, but we were utilizing that principle of how they like go about their research before starting a project. We were just using that and applying it to graphic design. So we were researching something new, but it was in service to Columbia to create a program there. So when I went to UMBC, I wasn't asked to create a new program. So my research, So I basically had a chance now to either continue research, but the original prompt for that research was not my own initial interest. It was in service to Columbia College, whereas when I went to UMBC, it was very important that it was my research interests, not the colleges or not the universities. It was my own. So that's kind of why I shifted it to my own. So for other people that are kind of weighing that decision, they got to look at the quality of their research and the long-term viability of it. And if they see it, you know, it's kind of a dead end, I would recommend starting over. But I mean, if you see something that you've already got a book out of it that's like in the works, and for whatever reason you do go to a new institution, yeah, you're definitely going to want to try to get some years towards tenure there, because, you know, your research interests aren't going to change. So I looked at it as a chance to start over, as opposed to something I was like heavily invested in that I really wanted to transfer over. So everybody's going to have, you know, be able to find their where they fit on that spectrum.
Very well said, and some really good advice there.
Well, hey, you know, that's the other thing. That's why I'm super excited that you're actually doing this, because I think all of us together as a, you know, as a profession, I can ask anybody this stuff and anybody will give me an answer, but you have to go seek it out. So the fact that you're actually putting all of this junk, this tribal knowledge that we have, into a common repository, that's just gonna, it's going to save somebody a lot of time and save all of us a lot of pestering down the road.
Oh my gosh, that is the hope.
Yeah, so no, it will do it. Simple as that. I love it.
Well, thank you. So I hear that you are putting your tenure packet together.
Yes, I am.
That is fantastic. So can you walk us through the steps or the breakdown of the tenure process at UMBC that you've gone through?
Sure. Yep. And it is different from what it was at Columbia, which was different than it was at Truman. So everybody take this with, you know, you got to put this into your own context. But UMBC, since I started from scratch, you have a 90-day, like at the end of your first semester, they do a review, which I like, you know, because if, you know, a UMBC is about like identifying problems early. So you have your 90-day review. Then you have your 3-year review at the beginning of your third year. So you are already like starting to like put paperwork and stuff together at the end of your second year. The reasoning behind that, it gives you a lot of time to course correct if, you know, there's problems. Whereas at, you know, Columbia College, your third year review happened at the end of your third year. So now you're already into your fourth year, the middle of your fourth year. And so now you've got like very little time to, you know, course correct. And so then at the end of, so then you have your 3-year review, and then you're kind of at, you know, Columbia College, UMBC, then you're kind of like left alone to, you know, go about it until you submit your tenure application in the fall of your sixth year. So there's periodical, there's like annual check-ins with the chair. But nothing real formal between that 3-year review and your 10-year review.
Wow.
So that's the overall process.
Okay.
Now, do you want to know about the support systems in place, or am I jumping the gun on that?
I would love to hear about the support systems, and I would love to hear about how you are compiling your packet.
Okay. So support system first, and then we'll talk about my packet. So the support system's in place. So UMBC, when you get there, they assign you a mentor, you know, from your department. So I have an official mentor from my department, who mine is Peggy Ray, and she's fantastic. She's the kind of person who has like the handbook memorized. And so like, there's always like, you know, this T dot this, cross that T, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I had an external. So I had an internal mentor. And then it wasn't policy when I started, but I got grandfathered into it because the second year there at UMBC, they then started a called a emerging scholar program, and where they you get to pick an external mentor. So you look for another tenured faculty at another institution somewhere to be your mentor, and you they get a small stipend from UMBC, and UMBC ponies up the money to send them to your institution, and then send you to theirs. So then they set this up so then you have somebody else to kind of give feedback and bounce things off as you go along. And then literally every summer, at the end of every academic year, and every they have different workshops for tenure and promotion. So there is you are not surprised by their process in any way, shape, or form. If you're surprised by the process, it's your own ignorance and your own fault.
That's a really great support system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it makes sense because the UMBC, they invest money in you via startup funds, and there's a lot of internal grant money and all this kind of stuff. They really invest money in you, and they don't want to, they want that to bear fruit. And not get lost in a technicality because you didn't know that you had to do this or do that. So they're very diligent in that. And other places, like I said, weren't as on it like UMBC was. But so I think that's because of the whole research, R2 institution is that they have the support systems in place. So as far as my packet goes, I think I'm in UMBC's and they're transitioning out. It's all digital now. So before,
that's great.
Yeah. So before, so when I went up for my 3-year review, I literally had to print everything out and put it into one of those, old legal expanding folders.
Oh no.
And there was a section for tenure. There was a section for, why am I blanking? Research. Scholar, research. I always call it research, but scholarship, same thing. So pardon the two different terms; they're the same exact thing. scholarship, teaching, and then service. And I just had to dump everything. I had to print everything out and put it into that. But me being the designer, I put all that into a PDF, and I think I swear to God, I think that sparked a bug, an idea in somebody. So now we submit it digitally. For tenure, it's now all digital. Quite frankly, it's so new that the system isn't open yet. So I can't start, building out my digital packet for internally for UMBC yet, because it's not, the portal isn't open yet.
That's amazing.
So there's that portion of it. And then there's also the, sending out the research scholarship portion of it to the external reviewers, and I haven't done that yet. I'm actually starting to think about that. Literally, that was one of the things I was what is that going to look like? What do I want to do for that? I was literally thinking about that today, because I can send something physical. At UMBC, it could be whatever you wanted. So I could literally make a website. I could literally print a book. I could throw everything in a folder, so I don't really have any kind of history to go on. So I'm kind of inventing it.
You get to set the benchmark.
In a way I do. And I don't know. And so right now I'm trying to gather some other people's and hey, what have you done? And I'm finding most everybody's in that pre, digital age where they're sending hard copies of stuff.
Oof.
So I'm anyway, so that's what I'm wrestling with right now. And, that involves, I'm also, I just got done with writing I think I've got to fight a tight first draft of my self-assessment. And my CV is always updated. That's just part of UMBC policy. Every April you have to submit your annual activity report, which includes updating your CV. So my CV is always up to date.
That's convenient to have that updated.
Yeah. So.
So with your packet, mm-hmm. You said that you kind of put everything in there. Mm-hmm. What is everything? So
that's a good question.
For when you are trying to document scholarship, teaching, and service, what does that look like?
Okay. I went through my 3-year review, and I do think the 3-year review versus tenure, while they're different, I do think they're also like the mechanisms are similar. So my 3-year review at Columbia, I got hammered because I put too much stuff in. Because I basically put in physical evidence of every like scholarly activity that I ever did. So at UMBC, you know, knee-jerk reaction, I probably in my 3-year review here at UMBC, I probably didn't put in enough. So what I've kind of come to is your dossier, and forgive me if this sounds dumb, because this is, I mean, it's probably pretty straightforward and we should all know this, but your dossier, if you like want to think about it, like in legal like proceedings, is the evidence. It's Exhibit A. So you need proof that your scholarly work is peer reviewed. So anything that wasn't peer reviewed, I pretty much automatically don't put in. So even if I created a website, you know, but if it wasn't peer reviewed, I didn't put it in during my 3-year review, which kind of burned me because they were like, well, hey, where was the making?
Oh no.
yeah. And it's like, and again, it was kind of like my fault, but, so like for me, in my problem was that, some of the things that were peer reviewed didn't necessarily have a physical manifestation. So in an art department, visual arts, what do you do with the stuff that you made that wasn't peer reviewed? So this time around, it's like I had to get creative about, you know, where to include that. And so some of the stuff that I was making was actually for my teaching. So I've included it in that section because I made an LMS for my students. Who's going to peer review that? But it's major work because it involved programming. It involved UI, UX testing, A/B testing, all the stuff that I did that I didn't give myself credit for because I didn't have the context. Well, in hindsight, I did have the context to put it in. So I put in teaching. For listeners, I have my own podcast. It's called Design EDU Today, where I'm trying to figure out, you know, the balance of like, you know, what should we be teaching, you know, contemporary designers. And so evidence of, you know, so it needs to be peer reviewed, right? For it to be evidence. So the website I made for it kind of doesn't have, so that doesn't really demonstrate my making. But the fact that it, you know, got the design incubation, it got their inaugural service award, UCDA, a peer reviewing body, invited me to, you know, conduct the podcast. So that's a peer review. I was selected for a conference in the fall, and my presentation is actually going to be on like using podcasting and Design EDU Today, you know, for furthering your research. So that becomes contents in my packet. So the visual manifestation of it yet, you know, I still don't quite know what to do with that yet, but I'll get there. Did that answer the question?
It did. It did. Yes, definitely.
Okay. And then it just like, you know, other evidence. It's all evidence. So, you know, service, you know, if the things that you've did, you know, how do you prove that you did it? How do you prove the value of the service that you did? So metrics, things that are measurable. I mean, that's the kind of information that needs to go in there.
Would that be like emails inviting you onto a certain committee or?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's part of it. I don't want to get off topic or not answer your question the right way, but I think that everything centers around the self-assessment, because the self-assessment is a document, is you making the argument for why what you did is nationally recognized or internationally recognized peer-reviewed research, service, and teaching. So that a self-assessment is like my undergrad professor, Jennifer Verlacchio-Grady, used to kind of think of it like the opening or closing arguments of a trial. You know, they're making the, it's making the point. And then you just need the evidence then to back up those arguments that you made, why what you did is research, tenure-worthy research. And so Exhibit A, Exhibit B, then that just goes into, you know, whatever mechanism that your institution has. So at UMBC, it's literally going to be a digital portal where I upload PDFs of emails that, you know, that I was invited to a conference or an email, you know, just like whatever kind of paper trail that you have, that whatever you award you won, whatever you got was, you know, legitimate. And so, you know, at Columbia, that was literally, I print it out and punch it and put it into a 3-ring binder. So the point is that all that, that's the actual evidence that is referenced in the self-assessment. And if you do your self-assessment right, you're making an argument to colleagues that may not be in your design field. You know, we have like 20 faculty in visual arts. Only 5 of us are design. We got animation, photo, and yada, yada, yada. So that self-assessment needs to convince them, make them understand, like, okay, great, I got an AIGA Design Educators grant. They don't know what that is. So even if I give them evidence that I won a grant that was peer-reviewed, they don't know the significance of that. So you need that self-assessment, you know, that evidence has to be like metrics. How many people did apply? You know, so this, wow, you know, how, what was the review process for all these different things? So that, all that's the kind of information that goes in the packet at UMBC is, you know, how do you make something that's totally abstract for somebody who's not a designer to know the value of the work you did? And it's your job to make them understand it via that document.
So save everything and start early. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Oh God. Yeah. 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 I have, I don't remember who I got. It was from somebody else. I was reading about some other woman who went up for tenure. She got it, but she's like, and it was like a totally disparate profession. I can't remember what it was anymore, but like she had like, she's like, in my email folders, I had one that was like feel good, warm, fuzzy stuff. And that warm, fuzzy stuff is you got accepted to a conference. Your work was in a publication, and you just put all those emails into that folder. So you can just go back and dig that evidence up later. But you got to check with your institution, because talking to some other people at other institutions, you know, they want like literally like the name badge from the conference that you went to, or like the conference proceeding, a printout of that. They want that as opposed to just the email that you were accepted. They want to see your name on a, you know, on a document somewhere. They actually want a real letter. So you just got to check with your institution to make sure that, you know, what collection mechanism that they want.
We get paperwork every year stating clearly what the tenure and promotion standards are. So hopefully each institution has that process is pretty transparent to everyone.
I hope so.
I know. Tell me about it. Well, it looks like we're almost at the end of our hour here. So do you have any other thoughts or upcoming projects or any other advice that you would like to share with our listeners?
All the above, but I got to respect your time. But the one piece of advice that I have to give this piece of advice, because, again, we're all designers, and I'm assuming the audience for this is mostly designers, but they're all in visual arts departments. And so you can't expect your colleagues to understand what your research is. Even by reading the self-assessment, you can't understand and expect them to understand that. So it's kind of your job, at least I perceive it that way, is to like very early on, just have casual like water cooler conversations, making sure you're talking with everybody. So they know what you're doing. So they know how to put it in context. So, you know, when it comes time for them to sit down as a body, you know, they can kind of like, if, you know, one colleague doesn't understand it, you know, another colleague can kind of like be your cheerleader and say, hey, you know, this is where this is coming from. Because if you just expect that because you won an award, well, here, let's just say you expect all your colleagues to understand that you won an award. Well, they don't, if they're not in your profession, they don't understand the value of that award. That award is meaningless to them unless they have the proper context for it. And the same thing with grants, you know, they don't know how competitive it is. I mean, these things could be like spit out like it's nothing. So you need to do these things both in that document in your dossier, but also just like one-on-one conversations. And the other thing, like, too, is, like, you need to, like, make sure that they're all on the same page with you when it regards to research. Like, I'm going to, like, throw out a hypothetical situation that somebody and I were, like, just, like, randomly, like, talking about. It's like, you could, let's say you're an animator, and you're making this, you made this book on, you know, this, like, amazing animation process. Well, your colleagues could totally trip you up, even though you published a book, because they could say, well, yeah, you're an animator. You need to animate. You need to make animations, not write about it. And the same, you know, vice versa. They could say like, okay, great, you won like this, like, you know, this animation award, but you didn't like really kind of do any, you know, like scholarship. You just made an animation. You didn't like write about it or any, you know, put it in any journals. So unless you do both of those things, you know, you kind of leave it open for somebody else to say, like, you know, misevaluate your scholarship. So I think you kind of like need to flush that stuff out beforehand, because if you don't, you know, you could be blindsided during your third year review, or, you know, hopefully once you make that mistake during your third year review, you course correct for your for tenure. So that was the only advice that I think is just talk to your colleagues more. It's unfortunately it's political. If you don't talk to them, they don't feel like they're not as invested in you. So why should they go to bat for you? I mean, they should just obviously base it all on your scholarship. But if they don't know how to evaluate your scholarship because they're in a different discipline and you haven't taken the time to make them want to invest in you, why would they? So that's my biggest, like, you know, advice is figure that out the minute you step into a tenure track position. As far as plugs, for myself, I want to plug the Design EDU Today podcast. I still got a ton of episodes that I recorded at the UCDA conference that I need to edit and get up on the website. And I also, it's been going on for 3 years now, and I have no idea who my audience truly is. So I'm going to be doing a listener survey. I've actually got it written. I've just made the mistake of, like, I want to design it myself and forms are a bear to make look nice, but also be, you know, accessible. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be coming up soon. So I want to, you know, plug that. Please fill out the survey if you've been listening to my podcast. And the last thing, I'm going to officially announce it now, even though I don't know if I'm supposed to or whatnot, but I don't care anymore. I've actually written a book. I've already submitted the final manuscript to the publisher, and we're now going through the editing and design phase. And that book's on the responsive web design process. Like right now, students and designers are how do they evaluate to know if their design decisions are going to look good on all the different devices that are out there? You're either going to design 1,000 different screens and you're, you know, prototyping software du jour, or you have to code it from scratch. So the book actually kind of is a hybrid. It says, this is the minimum that you need to design. This is the minimum HTML and CSS you need to like get the critical design decisions made as like a wireframe before you start actually designing in your layout program. And if you do that, you know, you'll kind of have like bulletproof web layouts. So that's what I'm, and so that's the other thing. So look for that. The end of 2018.
Oh, how exciting. We got a sneak peek.
Yep. Yeah, the publisher, it's CRC Press, but they, you know, because of marketing, you can't really do too much yet. So, but talking about it, that's not a problem.
Awesome. Very exciting. So, I cannot wait to read it.
I hope so. I hope it's a good resource for anybody who has to try to teach responsive. It also could be used for, some of the principles are the same for for app design, but it's primarily for web responsive design.
Great. All right. Well, thank you for your time and being on here, and I wish you
the best. Thanks for thinking of me.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish you the best of luck going through the tenure process too.
Oh, you know what? You asked like one of your questions that you pre-sent.
Sure.
I don't have an answer for, but I do want to talk to you about. You said, you know, anyone I want to nominate. And why I don't have anyone that I can think to nominate, I am fascinated by people who are already tenured, but who transfer positions. So did they transfer their full professor or associate professor over to a new institution? Do they have to start over? What does that whole process look like? So I don't know if that's something that's interesting to you or not, or fits within the grand scheme of your podcast, but that's a question I'd like to know the answer to.
Well, I think as time goes along and I myself get through the tenure process, that might be applicable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, regardless of, don't look at it as jumping ship, because that's not the intent of it, but it's like, how do you build your career post-tenure to make yourself ready for the next step? What is the next step if you want a next step? And so, I mean, I'm going through that now because I'm like at the end of the 6-year marathon. So I'm now like starting to like contemplate what the next step is. So that's why it's like, what happens after you become associate? So anyway, that's just how my mind works.
No. And it's been a question on my mind as well. What is the next step?
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's too early to be at the end.
Yep, exactly.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you again for your time.
Appreciate it.
Look forward to seeing you at the next conference.